Hello, and welcome to the IQEQ podcast, where we have conversations with industry experts to discuss trending topics within the global alternative funds sector. We help you to understand the landscape of the industry, deep dive into case studies with our guests, and bring fresh insight on things to look out for in the future.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to ESG Journeys, walking the talk from end to end. My name is Jax Vermeulen. I'm the Chief Commercial Officer at IQEQ here in Guernsey, and it's my pleasure to moderate our distinguished panel today. We have speakers from IQEQ, who are a global fund administration, private wealth, and corporate administration firm with over 4,000 employees globally in 25 jurisdictions. We are joined today by one of our valued clients, ADM Capital's Kibus Funds, a private equity vehicle created to invest in rapidly growing food chain companies that adopt technologies to enable the profitable and sustainable capture of high growth market and produce opportunities. Notably, the Kibus funds are proudly Guernsey Green funds. On today's panel, we have Andrea McAvoy, who has recently joined the asset management division of IQEQ Fund Management in Dublin as an ESG Research Associate Director. Andrea is responsible for leading ESG company research, discovering areas for company engagement, and enhancing ESG integration in the team's investment process. Andrea's insights will be integrated within the investment funds and bespoke client portfolios managed by her team. Prior to joining IQEQ, Andrea was a sustainability advisor at EY, supporting listed and private companies and PE firms navigate a wide range of ESG challenges, particularly increasing regulation. Prior to EY, she was head of responsible investing at Stamford Associates. Georgina Thomas is an ESG associate for the Kibus Funds, ADM Capital Europe, LLP. Prior to joining, Georgina was a senior associate for Worthstone, an impact investment consultancy, and has also developed and implemented sustainability strategies for multiple startup businesses. Georgina has a master's degree in climate change, finance, and management from Imperial College in London. Georgina's role at the Kibus Funds is the management of the firm's environmental and social management system, which governs the firm's integration of their theory of change through ESG and impact strategies. Georgina will bring the perspectives of a GP advisor to the discussion, highlighting the real life challenges and opportunities of the ESG market. Samad Naim has been with the wider IQEQ group for more than 10 years. Samad chairs our regulatory committee and has been involved with the launch of multiple regulatory and reporting products, including our IQEQ ESG Compass product, designed specifically to help our clients monitor and report their ESG exposure. Mark Harland is a sustainability, responsible investment, and impact leader with over a decade in the finance industry, specializing in and developing approaches to integrating ESG factors into investment decisions, engagement, and stewardship. He has advocated for meaningful change within the investment industry, engaging with fund managers, executives, and non-executive directors on a wide variety of issues from corporate governance to executive compensation. Mark joined IQEQ in July 2021 and is responsible for the group's sustainability strategy and would also be supporting the development of IQEQ Compass. Mark is currently in the final year of his master's degree with Cambridge University at the world-renowned Institute for Sustainable Leadership. With introductions done, we'd like to say, please feel free to post any questions throughout our presentation today, and we will have some time at the end to answer these questions. So turning to our first question, perhaps we can begin by asking our panelists to tell us about their ESG journey so far, including some of the challenges they have faced. Samad, can we start off with you?
Thanks, Jax. And yes, the ESG journey, as for many of you, became more and more significant for us in the last few years. And towards the end of 2019, through our horizon scanning, we were seeing a lot of ESG-related regulations coming up from different parts of the world, which made us think that our clients will soon be starting to ask us for a lot of more ESG support in the coming months and years. And that was the time that we decided that we should have an ESG product. And throughout sort of like 2020, we were talking to our clients and to different sort of market participants, our law firm friends and others, and see what is the could be the ESG sort of scope for them and what is the support that they need. And based on that, in 2021, in January, we launched our ESG product. And since then, it has been an amazing sort of like journey together with our clients, and have seen a remarkably busy sort of months since then. And considering that, even though the regulatory push has mainly come in from Europe, and we have had like the most of the meetings in Europe with our clients, but US and sort of like Asia and Africa are also not far behind. So we are seeing a lot of push from those regions as well. And in total, we have had like more than 200 different meetings with our clients on this. And it's not just clients, even the intermediary firms, for example, law firms or other sort of accounting firms that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. They have also shown great sort of like appetite to understand what operationally ESG means. And some of these sort of like meetings that we have had with law firms, for example, have had more than sort of like 70 lawyers participate in those meetings. So there is a great sort of like push and a need for ESG for all the different stakeholders that IQ deal with.
Thanks, Ahmad. And turning to Andrea, can I ask what your journey's been like?
Thanks, Jack. My journey has spanned, firstly, as you mentioned, the perspective of reviewing ESG from practices of asset managers at Stanford, and then secondly, the practices and challenges for corporates with EY. And now I have the opportunity to bring all that knowledge together and lead public company ESG research for the IQEQ asset management team. From my interactions, I think most companies and investors have a desire to be authentic and see value in applying ESG risk and opportunity lenses to their businesses. The challenge or the friction sometimes comes when businesses and investors are on this journey while also simultaneously being asked for extensive and sometimes at times unrealistic data disclosures from different stakeholders. So as an example, the asset managers under the current European Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, or SFDR as we'll be familiar with, are being asked to disclose information that the companies themselves, which they invest in, are about 2 to 3 years away from disclosing. I'm talking about the EU taxonomy and the requirements for Article 8 and Article 9 funds. There's also another stat that's kind of bouncing around for the principal adverse indicators for SFDR, which says that in practice, only 1 in 5 large companies can provide this information and 1 in 50 small caps. So you can really there, you know, kind of think and understand the challenges for investors. And as I said, from the corporate side as well, companies are really grappling with extensive disclosure requirements, which are particularly focused on climate. The challenge of this data disclosure has a ripple effect as well, which we need to be cognizant of, because large companies place these demands on smaller companies, particularly when they think about things like supplier interactions, etc. So they're probably a summary of some of the challenges I've seen to date.
Thank you, Andrea. A very interesting point about the ripple effect of data demands impacting SMEs. Georgie, perhaps this is something that you have had direct exposure to in your ES journey to date.
Yes, for sure. I mean, so the Kivis funds were founded back in 2016 with the, innate underlying objective of developing a sustainable, equitable and secure future food system. And I think over the years, the development of global frameworks, corporates and investment companies and you know, the public markets have all branched out, and there is a more formulaic way of looking at impact investing in ESG risk analysis. But I think, and the classic phraseology here is obviously it is a journey, because you look at these types of investments and you look at the fact that it's very nuanced, that there's a lot of areas that are new to the market. Many people are being educated in how to integrate ESG and finance together. It's a kind of new era, and finding the nexus between those two is definitely a challenge. But I think that the data one has been one of the most difficult for us, mostly just because of collecting certain data points can be difficult for management teams. For example, like going back to the educational point, in the climate data and biodiversity data, collecting those data points from our portfolio companies, you need to either be able to educate those management teams on how to collect that data, whereby most of these companies are smaller and don't have an expert in-house to help with the measurement and management of those data points, or you need to bring in external advisory. And because some of those areas, I mean, climate and GHG emissions have now got quite a formulaic structure after the Greenhouse Gas Protocol and under those requirements. But I think biodiversity and looking at beyond simply climate data and making sure that we're, you know, assessing all of the factors included within the principal adverse indicators that Andrea mentioned earlier, that is a difficult area for us and a challenge for many private equity firms and GPs at the moment, ensuring that they're fulfilling those regulatory requirements that Andrea was mentioning earlier. It's, you know, the principal adverse indicators coming under SFDR and the requirements of our LPs to adhere to those, and making sure that we supply them with the data that they need to report under that regulation is becoming more and more important. And working alongside those companies to ensure that we're our LPs, sorry, to making sure that we're collecting that data in the best way. And I think it's very much a partnership at the moment, because we're all trying to understand that regulation. And I think the last point that I have to make with regard to challenges is actually just developing effective strategies on a company by company basis. I think when I came into this role, you know, less than 2 years ago now, but it was very much in the public equities industry, it's you're looking at quite a formulaic way of analysing ESG risk. But when you're effectively managing companies that you have majority ownership over or far greater influence with regards to your engagement, developing those effective strategies that work for each company is very different. Working with different management teams, working with different business models, I think that it's not a one size fits all, which I think a lot of the impact in the ESG market, because it's trickled down from the public equity sector, the PE market has tried to integrate those and it's not worked as well. So having to do it on a company by company basis and really developing out a strong engagement strategy on ESG and not having a divided line between the investment teams and the ESG teams within your firm, but rather making sure that everyone is integrated on that strategy. Those are some of the challenges that we've seen.
Lovely. Thanks, Georgie. Fascinating insight for us all to hear what it's like at the manager, at the client. So thank you. Mark, just turning to you lastly, but certainly by no means least, on the topic of portfolio companies, as Georgie's mentioned there, how has the journey been for you?
Yeah, thanks, Jackson. And thanks to the other panelists and some of the comments that Georgie was just making kind of resonated significantly with me in terms of the experience that we've had. Certainly when we are engaged by investors, we tend to see boilerplate questionnaires coming through, and I think this is a big challenge for many portfolio companies within the private equity space, is that you get to consult, you get RFP questions and that come that are handed down by consultants that aren't geared to the business that they're asking questions of. So, for example, I had an RFP come through the other day, which, you know, started to ask me about my, you know, agricultural policy. Now, for those of you that know IQEQ, we're not an agricultural business. So, you know, asking about an agricultural policy seems a little ludicrous. And it's things like that which really kind of are quite a big, you know, whilst you can ignore the question, it takes time to go through all of these RFPs to actually work out, you know, what people are, you know, what people want from you, and what information you're prepared to give. And each, you know, each RFP that comes through is timely. It takes a lot of effort to answer. So I think one of the big challenges is to Georgie's point, is about, you know, bespoke engagement, and making sure that you know, when you're working with portfolio companies, that you understand exactly what you're asking them of. Other challenges that I see for us as a portfolio company is you know, the size of and this pace of regulation and the change in regulation. We have, you know, 35 offices across 24 jurisdictions within IQEQ, across, you know, 4,000 people, as you mentioned in the introduction, and having to understand regulation in each of those jurisdictions is particularly difficult, and requires quite a concerted effort. So I think, you know, regulation is a challenge for portfolio companies like ours. And the as is the kind of the various degrees of engagement from clients and investors. Another challenge, you know, for us as portfolio companies, and this is just to pick up on what Andrea and Georgie have said already, is around data acquisition. You know, we find, you know, as I mentioned, we're quite a large business. You know, getting data from our various different businesses can be quite challenging. Whether it's climate-related data, so, you know, whether it's energy usage, converting that to CO2 numbers, whether it's diversity numbers, you know, whether it's engaging with office fit outs, and making sure that we have the right people in the room discussing the right topics. But all of these things are really quite, they're not rocket science, but they're challenges. And I would echo the sentiments of my fellow panelists in saying that, you know, data acquisition is absolutely critical, but it's also, you know, a significant challenge. Sorry, that was a bit of a ramble, but hopefully it made sense.
No, thanks, Mark. And interesting to hear that you're going to be becoming a farmer in your spare time too. So, Mark, we noticed you mentioned the conflicting interests, and on that note, I'm interested to hear about what, if any, trends our panel are seeing in ESG priorities and demands. Andrea, I'll come to you to ask for your thoughts firstly.
Yeah, no problem. From my experience over the last year, I've been focusing, or my ESG focus has been on supporting large listed companies prepare for increasing ESG disclosure and also grapple with the kind of fast moving landscape that Georgie and Mark were outlining, and thinking about how that really impacts the fundamentals of their business and strategy. So I think against that backdrop, and to reiterate it again, one of the major priorities has been preparing for regulatory disclosure. And the regulatory disclosure that public companies are facing is the disclosure tomorrow that private and small businesses are going to face, because there's a size limit that expands to bring everybody into scope in time. So just for a bit of context, after COP last year, COP26, the UK made it mandatory for large UK companies to disclose climate-related risk in their annual reports. So that's the TCFD from April 22 this year. In the US, we have the SEC talking at the moment about climate-related disclosures as well too, albeit facing some interesting pushback from a number of parties. And that would come into place for FY23 reporting for large corporates. And then finally in Europe, which has probably been the most progressed and has the most complicated legislation in place, we're looking at the introduction of the EU taxonomy this year. So listed companies have already began to try report in line with that framework, which is a very extensive classification system for companies and investors to disclose to what extent their investments and their activities are truly green. So quite welcome legislation, albeit difficult at the moment for many to get their arms around. And then the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, or CSRD, which will replace the current NFRD, will come into place from FY24. And that is really a significant step change in terms of what companies are being asked to disclose, and also who is being asked to disclose. So at the moment, the current legislation impacts about 10,000 companies. We're going to see that step up to 50,000 companies and really see a strong push for the kind of integrity and the insurance behind it, the assurance that the company's data they're providing, sorry. So I think that would be my summary in terms of what the priorities have been in the last year for large public companies. It's been really trying to get their arms around this mounting challenge, because this data, as Mark was saying, doesn't kind of come overnight. And for large businesses with extensive footprints around the world, you have to think about systems in place and pulling that information. So although the timelines might seem far away of FY24 reporting, it's really tomorrow for a lot of businesses if you don't start to put in place that system and reporting structure.
Thanks, Andrea. And contrasting your public sphere versus Georgie's private sector, Georgie, what trends are you seeing?
I think to take from that point on the regulation, and then I can just talk to some of the other trends that we're seeing. I mean, as an investor that operates within the impact space and the ESG risk analysis space as well, RLPs tend to have a focus on that as well, and they tend to have requirements on regulation and data. And I think as they're becoming subject to that regulation across, whether that's the EU, whether that's the UK's evolving regulation, whether that's, you know, that belongs to the FCA, or whether that's the Securities Exchange Commission, I think it's all trickling down to the companies that they need to get data from, the investment firms that they've put pools of capital into. And so obviously in some way we're now subject to ensuring that data is provided to them through that chain. And so it's definitely a trend with regard to beginning to collect that data, even if we're not subject to that regulation as of yet, supplying it to RLPs as well. And especially a focus within that on climate. There's been a big push for climate data, and an interest from conversations that we've had with LPs, as well as the diversity and inclusion. I mean, climate focus tends to look at, our EU LPs tend to have a stronger focus on climate, and our American LPs tend to have a much stronger focus on diversity and inclusion. So those seem to be trending across those two different continents. And then with regard to some other trends that we're seeing, I think especially in the impact space, setting strategies to incentivize staff within portfolio companies, so actually using economic incentives, so aligning long-term incentive plans, short-term incentive plans with ESG targets in order to ensure that to promote the achievement of ESG within those companies as well. Personally, from the experience that I've had within the Kibbis Funds, the management that we choose have to have a strong commitment and capacity to fulfill ESG requirements. And we engage with those companies from day one, and we have a very strong engagement process. I'm very closely aligned with the deal teams and the management teams. But I think the trends there is very much looking to show that impact and achieving impact is aligned with incentive plans, as well as you know, the reduction of ESG risk. I think there needs to be there's sort of the balance there that we've been seeing, is that you're looking at reducing the risk through incentive plans, but also enhancing the impact. And I think there's sort of two sides to that seesaw. And then one of the other things is trends, you know, really formalizing your impact strategy, really making sure that everything is in place with regard to managing impact. That's definitely grown over the past few years, especially, you know, having those frameworks like the theory of change and sort of operating principles of impact management, and not just saying, oh, we're impactful because we're an SFDR Still 9 fund, but actually, like the title of this is walking the talk, and, you know, and being able to say, yes, we are Article 9, but we have all of these things that aren't just related to the Article 9 requirements, but go beyond that to look at impact. I think that many people who sit in the impact space will agree with me that much of the change that is coming from creating impact hasn't come yet or from regulation, but rather from other impact frameworks. So I think that that's definitely a trend that we're seeing as well.
Oh, sorry, Mark, we've just got one of the old you're on mute moments.
Yeah, sorry. I should have a sign saying schoolboy error. Apologies. I was going to pick up on this trend that Georgie was mentioning, was, you know, this idea of impact. I think there's a significant shift change. And Andrea, maybe not to play moderator here, Jake, but it would be interesting to get your thoughts on kind of the shift between ESG, which to my mind has always been kind of backwards looking and always kind of balance sheet driven, kind of like a balance sheet of the performance of a company. So, you know, your carbon performance, you know, what was that in the last year? You know, how many women do you employ? You know, how many people of color? All of these things are kind of metrics which you can ascertain, you know, and kind of report on, and that's your kind of your ESG story versus, you know, what is your impact, and, you know, what is your impact on the world at large. I think there's, in my experience, you know, in previous roles, I think there was I did a lot of work in public equities, and I think there was a lot of focus on shifting the focus from ESG into kind of what is your impact. So just I think that's a huge trend that I was seeing when I was in the public markets. It's also one of those things that I think gets really confused. You know, people don't really understand the difference between the Sustainable Development Goals and ESG. But I did ask Andrea a question, so maybe I can give her an opportunity to come in before I ramble on.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. The data requirements are definitely still backward looking from a formulaic point of view, but where it's much more meaningful, I think this is where and why you should look to have an ESG specialist or analyst involved in your process, ideally from an asset manager perspective, because it does take someone to put on the thinking hat to think, is this company actually committed to moving the dial, and do they understand the challenges? I think the science-based targets are an interesting one. I mean, off the back of COP last year, we've seen an awful lot of companies commit. What I'm interested to see now is how they're putting in place those KPIs and actually moving to achieve those targets, because it is significant to really move a business in the direction of science-based targets or net zero. So we have a lot of 2050, a lot of 2030, a lot of, you know, grandiose kind of objectives out there. But these next 2, 3, 5 years, I'd be really keen to see some numbers behind that trajectory to actually having meaningful impact in reducing your footprint, because that's ultimately what we're trying to. What this big push is that we have this backdrop of an impending climate issue where we're running out of time, and we need to make businesses and people have less of an impact, and we need that rather than a lot of data, because it's an overload for investors, and it's the overload for the companies as well too, to actually think about what's the impact of this business it's not the agricultural footprint of IQEQ. It's something, you know, much more focused on perhaps the people, perhaps their science-based objectives. And are we going to see some targets coming out, and can we support those businesses to Georgie's point as well too? Because it's not just going to work if it's the large public businesses that are on the journey. It has to ripple down to the smaller SMEs as well too.
Yeah, that resonates with me as well in terms of kind of the climate journey that we're on. You know, at IQEQ, we first need to have a baseline understanding of where we are, which is obviously the data piece, and getting all of those, you know, on climate in particular, you know, getting scope 1 and scope 2 data is actually quite easy. It's where you start to get into scope 3 data, which is particularly difficult. But having a robust number around which you can then coalesce and kind of set strategy and say, well, you know, we're going to, you know, decrease our emissions by 25% by 2025. You know, we want to be completely carbon neutral by 2030. I'm not saying that that's IQEQ strategy right now, but certainly one of my ambitions is for us to be, you know, carbon neutral at some point in the future. But, you know, how you get there is, you know, a bit of a challenge. You know, it's you kind of going, not necessarily, you're not working in the dark so much as you're kind of feeling your way through a number of different, you know, priorities and engagements, and you know, I'm you know, we mentioned conflicts of interest. You know, there is this, you know, there's the commercial aspect that we need to consider as well, right? And you know, a lot of this comes at cost for the business, and certainly within IQEQ, there's competing, you know, we're trying to knit together, you know, 17, 18 different acquisitions over the last 4 years. Culturally, that's a challenge, right? And you've got to bring people on board, and for people's business, you know, one would argue that, you know, culture is probably for us a bigger issue than climate change. But we've got to do both.
Yeah, the consultants like to call it the decarbonization pathway. That's what they'll try and sell you. But I don't believe that there's any straightforward decarbonization pathway. And I really hope that going forward, it's about seeing meaningful progress and taking into account the business challenges as well too, because it's not a linear path. And that there's support for trying to go in a direction while equally grappling with other challenges to keep business afloat. Mm.
Yeah, and I think like if we sort of like look at what Andrea, Mark, and Georgie have already said, it's a ESG story is it, like probably the best way to put it is that ESG story is a story with multiple plots in it. So we have already sort of like talked about private versus public, plus there is the bit on the different geographies that you see, like Europe being the sort of like foremost on this, but then other sort of like geographies catching up. You also have this divide between the E, S, and G, where E is the one that everyone is sort of looking at the moment. But then social and governance bits are coming in as well pretty quickly, especially the social bit, and governance is sort of like being attached to E in the first place anyway. And then we also talked about like the backward looking and the forward looking thing. So, and this is all sort of what is sort of driving the sort of market at the moment and the people that we talk to. And what we are also seeing is that there's another sort of like plot in the whole thing. And that is people who are just starting on the ESG journey, which is the sort of like minimum compliance firms, as we call them, and who at the moment need a lot of hand-holding and are sort of like worried that they are being burdened with these 2,000 different ESG regulations and provisions coming out from different parts of the world and 1,500 different KPIs that they could possibly track on this. And then you have these firms who are sort of like in the foundation stage, who are sort of like done with the first part of ESG. They know where they want to go, but they have to do a lot of policies and procedures, need to put the KPIs in place, and track them. And then you have these firms like the Advanced Achievers, ones like ADM, who are sort of like already there on the journey, have been tracking the data, and now they need to see what is the next with that data. What is like, how do they take that data to the next level in terms of creating value for the stakeholders that are there, plus also seeing how the valuation of those portfolio companies and others can be enhanced by using that data. And that is, these are the sorts of like trends that we are seeing in terms of the demands. And every day is a different day for us in terms of talking to clients and seeing how we can help them.
Thank you, Samad. So climate change has been mentioned. Georgie and Mark, could you talk to us a little bit about the importance of this area?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's, like I said earlier, it is a major trend for a lot of our stakeholders. And of course, the impacts of climate change, I mean, of course, as many of the listeners here will be based in Europe this year, we've seen some pretty horrendous droughts. The impacts on agriculture and the future of food, and even with inflation being the way it is, it's within agriculture, it's going to become more difficult because of the impacts of climate change and the effects on crop yields. And I think it's an area, like Andrea was saying earlier, the data collection is so important, but also the engagement is even more important. And it's difficult when you hear of people being like, oh, disclosure is the going to take up all of your time. And when you think about it, if you've got a small team and your disclosure and your accounting is going to take up all of your time, it's very difficult, because ultimately the disclosure and reporting is there to support you to go back to your portfolio companies and say, this is what needs to change. These are the areas that we need to address. But with a lot of these requirements that are coming out, it may render some people not able to do that. And so I think that there needs to be considerations from LPs on what is required of their portfolio companies with regard to the level of engagement on climate change, and an understanding that the companies are doing what they can by working with the management teams to reduce and hopefully increase the carbon sequestration, but also reduce emissions as well, and not just simply step straight to offsetting. But I also think that the last point that I will add to this answer is that we must not get something called climate tunnel vision, which within the sustainability transition, there seems to be over the past 10 years, 20 years, that there's been a focus from a lot of people on something called carbon tunnel vision, which is where basically everyone just looks towards carbon emissions as a way to move into sustainability. There's so many other issues that interconnecting with not only the impacts of climate change, but it's the causation of climate change. You know, the water crisis, biodiversity loss, education, resource scarcity, inequality, all of these things that, you know, overconsumption of goods and the lack of circularity in our system, all are interlinked, and companies need to view all of these issues when they're looking at the investment process, when they're managing companies throughout the entire investment cycle, and that climate change isn't the be all and end all of your investment strategy. I'm not saying that it's not extremely important to focus on, because it is, and ultimately will have, you know, devastating impacts if you're not trying to make a change now. But there also needs to be a concentration of the other impacts that your portfolio companies are having, and making sure that you're addressing those to the finer details, and really reviewing them with the management teams that you're working alongside, and incentivizing them to address those areas, because there is a monetization of carbon, and I think that's a really positive thing, but there needs to be we need to address the other impacts as well, so that we can resolve issues and create resilience and adapt to climate change.
Yeah, I completely agree with Georgie that there is, you know, there's a myriad of issues, a plethora of issues that companies should be looking at and considering. And I think she outlines, you know, what she's just outlined kind of is an indicator of the challenge around sustainability, you know, in terms of, you know, what we need to be aware of and you know, what we need to think about. You know, biodiversity loss, for example, you know, is a massive, massive problem that people just, I think, are now starting to wake up to. But, you know, if we lose biodiversity, you know, that is the bottom of the pyramid. The whole pyramid of society, you know, ends up collapsing. And I don't think that's, you know, hyperbole. you know, I think there's some serious challenges around that. But, you know, to come back to climate change, I think climate change is probably the canary in the coal mine. You know, it is the one thing that you're able to measure, you know, from an energy, you know, albeit there are challenges around measuring it, is in particular around scope 3 emissions. But, you know, it's something that's measurable. It has some sort of cost associated with it. And you can kind of plan around it. And if we're not able to get that right, then, you know, what hope do we have for the rest? And I suppose that's the kind of unnerving, you know, from a sustainability perspective or a sustainability professional's perspective, that's the kind of unnerving part of this, is that, you know, there is such a big challenge, and there is so much work that we need to do. And then if we can't get carbon and climate change right, then what hope do we have for biodiversity? But I think there is, you know, there is hope, you know, around climate change. I think, you know, you look at the cost of renewable energy coming down significantly over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, and the amount of kind of investment going into renewable energy, I think is hugely, hugely impressive. You know, and we need to see more of that sort of stuff. You know, and obviously we need governments to take the lead, because companies can't operate, you know, we don't operate in vacuums, and we need regulation to kind of really push the agenda. We need to stop subsidizing fossil fuels, and, you know, really kind of shifting that money into renewable energy. From an IQEQ perspective, you know, our focus is on predominantly on managing our scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, and looking to kind of reduce those. So, you know, where we are, for example, where we are looking to move into new buildings, we're looking to move into BREEAM listed buildings, we're looking to change our energy mix. So, you know, looking at bringing in renewable energy into our buildings, powering our buildings with renewable energy, moving away from gray energy, and we're looking to do that, you know, systematically and, you know, one office at a time. So I'll stop there, Jack.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. No, thanks. I think just two more questions for me before we open up to our audience for questions. And this one is on regulation. I'll come to Andrea and Samad to talk of the area of regulation. Is this helping matters or muddying already unclear waters?
I think the water is muddy at the moment for companies and for investors, because we have an alphabet soup of different regulations, disclosures, reporting frameworks, GRI, SASB, CSRD, SFRD, you can go on. And the danger is that this creates a premise of throwing the kitchen sink at ESG data disclosure rather than thinking about the ESG actions that will truly have a meaningful impact for climate and societal issues. You know, as Georgie was just saying, this climate or carbon tunnel vision and really, you know, overlooking the interlit issues that are emerging at quite an upsetting pace. However, the hope is that we get some convergence with a lot of the large juggernauts of ESG regulation that are coming down the line, in particular in Europe. Corporates and companies that have a large ESG presence are going to have to get up to standard with the EU taxonomy and the CSRD. And as I said before, that is a real step change aimed at reducing greenwashing and also getting non-financial data up to the same rigor and standard as financial data. So I think, you know, given the backdrop that we've been talking about, unfortunately, this stern regulatory push is required if we're going to see the reallocation of assets to achieve the necessary global climate and sustainability objectives that are in place. As I was saying before, it's important not to kind of lose the back thought of why we're really pushing, why climate has been pushed in particular, as Mark was saying. And that's this view that, you know, there's a 50% chance in the next 5 years that we're going to break that 1.5 degree threshold. And that has meaningful impact for our day-to-day lives, particularly in developing world as well too, if we want to talk about impact. So the regulatory stick is needed, definitely. It's just hopefully that it gets applied with some degree of pragmatism as well too, for the different business challenges that we've been discussing today.
Yeah, and I would just like to add on this that the regulation that we have talked about is Europe has been the sort of like biggest powerhouse on that, but on even from Europe now the second level is coming through. So previously we saw the regulations coming in and the sort of like European regulators releasing Q&A and things on this, but now the national regulators are in the picture as well, and they are releasing their own sort of like Q&A on this, because in the end it is going to be the national regulators who will sort of like will be doing this testing whether people are complying with the regulations or not. And I think that is it going to be another level on this regulatory sort of like stream, where the national regulators will then start sort of like looking at all the disclosures that will start coming out from next year, and then will be sort of like saying whether they are compliant or not. And wherever previously regulators have sort of looked at regulatory disclosures, especially on ESG in Europe or US, that has not been sort of like the best of news for many of the fund managers. So I think it's going to be a next level that we'll start seeing from next year.
Great, thanks, Ahmed. Last question from me. We've heard a lot about the various ESG challenges facing businesses. How can these issues be resolved? What solutions are available and how effective are they? We'll come to Georgie and Samad on these questions. Georgie, we'll start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a variety, but obviously, of course, we'll speak to simply just the from a GP perspective. I think for investors and managers of assets, there needs to be engagement from day one. I think this is what I found at Kibbutz, and it's such an important focus for us, is that ultimately if you engage with the management teams and the staff and the deal teams at the potential investment from day one, you explain to them what your strategy will be, and you work with them to understand how you can integrate that into the business. I think that it also needs to be an understanding that they're very, very knowledgeable in their business, and you are very knowledgeable in understanding how to integrate ESG, and there needs to be a partnership there. I think that has been our most effective strategy with regard to enhancing the impact of our portfolio companies and ultimately reducing ESG risk associated with them. I think a little bit of personal skills comes in handy. I think that's been definitely a solution for us, is that working alongside our companies and being personable on the matters of ESG. the incentive programs that we've now developed and we've started implementing have made a huge difference. Of course, there are a couple of success stories. For example, we've recently acquired a particular portfolio company called Widcott Seedlings that's in based in Australia, and I think it's been a brilliant journey. We started looking at this investment about a year and a half ago, and we made the investment back in April of last year, and we have really developed a strong relationship with the team, and now the entire long-term incentive plan is actually based on ESG and impact achievements. I think that's actually probably a first time for industry. I mean, if you look at most public companies and even into private equity portfolios, it's usually less than 20% that's attached to ESG. We're focusing on 100% of incentive programs for that portfolio company over the next 5 years to be based on ESG requirements and achievements. And so I'm pretty proud of having that implemented within our portfolio companies. And I hope to see that travel through the rest of the Kibbis Fund portfolios as we acquire more companies. I think it will make a huge difference to how we solve some of the challenges that we face and how the management team are engaged on certain matters. And then also, I think just setting a strong framework, making sure that your investment team are educated, updated and engaged on what your strategy is, understanding your theory of change, and that there's not a line between that and the ESG team. And I think that stems from senior management, but I also think that there needs to be a cohesion amongst the entire company and understanding of what you're trying to create with your business model, just beyond financial achievement, but actually the impact of your business and what you're trying to achieve beyond financial gain. So I think that those are the points that I have to say that have made really the biggest difference.
Yeah, and I would say that, like, as I mentioned earlier, ESG story is a story with multiple plots, and you just have to see which sort of like plot you're dealing with before providing a solution. And the one sort of like that fits in which like many of the stakeholders fit is the one which is more chronological in the sense that are you starting on the journey? Are you in the middle of the journey? Or are you sort of like in the advanced stages of your journey? And the demand for all of these participants is different. So if you are starting on the journey, then you need to understand what is your journey going to be looking like. And then you plan accordingly for each stage of your journey, whether you're fundraising or you're making investments or are you exiting. And what is going to be the disclosure for you? What is going to be the regulatory push for you? And you plan accordingly. And in that way, it could really help that you talk to someone who has seen this journey through and could be able to help you with that. And then if you are sort of like in the middle stage of the journey, then you need a lot of policies and procedures or setting up the KPIs and things. And again, I think we are in a good place now that so many companies have sort of like put in there in the wider space out there what they are doing about the ESG sort of space. And again, that is something that can help a lot in terms of like driving that middle stage. And the final is the advanced sort of like achievers who have a lot of data at the moment and need to make sure how do they take it to the next level. And there are lots of opportunities available in that space in terms of like how do you benchmark your data against different things, how do you sort of see what is the how do you calculate the impact on the stakeholders that you have. And although this is probably the least sort of like focus space at the moment, I think that is going to be the biggest sort of like development in the months and years to come.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Georgie and Sarmad, for those insights. So that's all the questions from me. I'd like to say a very big thank you to our panel today. We've had some thought-provoking insights and really interesting to hear from the side of a client, from the side of a manager, what goes into the thought process. So thank you, Georgie, for joining us today. I'm going to invite and open up questions from our audience, and we've seen a couple of questions coming in. So I'm going to start off with a fairly open question of, where does the ESG responsibility lie in an organization? I think for this one, I'll go to Mark first. I saw a big smile on Mark's face there as our head of sustainability at IQEQ. Mark, can I ask for your thoughts on where the ESG responsibility lies in an organization?
Yeah, no, certainly. So I think this is a trick question. I think the responsibility for ESG, in my opinion anyway, is across the business, right? I don't think it sits with any one individual. I'm the head of sustainability. That's clear for IQEQ. You know, I help set the strategy. I think the board obviously has clear responsibility for managing that strategy. Ultimate responsibility for the business. But you know, I think realistically, you know, when it comes to things like diversity, for example, you know, that's something that can, you know, individuals can manage themselves. You know, hiring managers can think about themselves. You think about your unconscious bias, you think about your impact on the organization. You know, the traditional answer is the board has ultimate responsibility for the business, but you know, I'd like to argue that, you know, ESG is not something that you farm off to, you know, one department and say those guys look after it. I think, you know, there needs to be collective responsibility across the firm. Maybe controversial.
No, that's the right answer. Thank you, Mark. Second question in from our audience today, and this is an interesting one. It's a bit topical in the news. You may have seen recently, in contrast to the regulatory push we have seen from Europe, there seems to be an anti-ESG movement in the US at the moment. Can our panel comment at all on their views? And again, I'll come to Andrea. I saw Andrea's eyes light up when this question came in. So Andrea, can I ask for your thoughts?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So we're seeing in the US that many states are providing kind of pushback or contesting the premise of the SEC for asking for climate-related disclosure information. And there's also some large pension funds that are asking their investment managers or asset managers to divorce fundamental and fiduciary responsibility from ESG. My personal view is that they're not mutually exclusive. And, you know, drawing on my years of both investment and ESG experience, I would not like to personally be investing assets with a manager that ignores ESG risk. I think that it relates directly to financial risk. And that's also where the US SEC is coming from. They typically ask for companies to disclose anything that's material to the business for investors to understand. Given the changing environment that we're going to see in the next few years, all companies should be aware of how climate risk is impacting their business potentially. The other point that I'd make is that although, you know, Europe is quite stern and moving, you know, at pace with regulation, it's not just for European specific businesses. So those 50,000 companies that I mentioned up from 10,000. It includes all US or international businesses that have a large European presence. So I don't think your US businesses are going to be able to avoid the tide of regulation coming from Europe. And then you also have to think that many investors, as they are meeting their regulatory requirements, they'll also be pushing it forward onto the companies as well too. So my hope is that it's noise and that there's so many other stakeholders that are pushing forward this agenda that they kind of end up being relatively isolated or don't have a meaningful impact to, you know, change the direction of travel.
Great. Thank you for the insight, Andrea. I think we've got time for one more question, which has just come in from our audience. And the question is, what key risks or liability can you see arising for players within this space, from portfolio companies to fund managers, if they get things wrong? I think we're thinking misreporting or otherwise.
It's quite a challenging question, that. But I think I could take it from a sort of GP perspective. Look, I think at the moment, in discussions with our compliance team and our head of legal about this issue, about being in line with and the liability that we may be subject to with future regulation. I think seeing some of the challenges that larger companies like DWS and the investigations that are currently going on in the US from the SEC, I think that companies do need to be careful. But I also think there's a space of understanding from regulators that these things take time. And having discussed with our head of legal that this is an area that the frameworks are not fully developed yet. There's a lot of discrepancy. The recent RTS of the SFDR sort of goes back on certain things and has changed. And there's the definitions for certain areas within the SFDR. There are some discrepancies there. So I think that the next 5 years we'll see as long as there's an intent and the intent to disclose and the structure of reporting is explained and as to why you believe as a business you're in line with the regulation and how you've interpreted that regulation, and there's an explanation of what the interpretation is, I think there's very much an understanding that hopefully you will be in line. But I think there are, after a five-year period of everyone reporting and there's a standardization created, I think there could be increased liability and risk for these companies. And I think that once there's consistency, there will be risk with regards to the future of regulation. But I think at the moment everyone is just at that primary stage and we're just learning about how to accept the regulation, how to interpret it, and then also how to report it. And I think that there's understanding from companies that as long as you're trying to limit your greenwashing or not greenwashing, I think that hopefully the future of your you really are trying to mitigate those risks with regards to reporting and just being honest, as honest as you can, because there are challenges that we face. There are things that we haven't done completely correctly in every way. And being honest with your stakeholders and your shareholders about some of the performance figures that have been going on, you're going to have the ability for everyone to be more aware of the challenges that are faced. And hopefully the future of reporting will become clearer and there will be less greenwashing.
Thanks, Georgie. It's that partnership approach, isn't it? We're in it together. Yeah. Thanks very much. Guys, that's time for us today. So thank you very much to the panel for the insights. And thank you to our audience who have given up an hour of their time today. It's been a really enjoyable discussion today. And thank you very much to everybody for joining.
Thanks for listening. To stay up to date with the latest news and insights in this fast-moving industry, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. And to listen back to previous episodes or find out more about the solutions IQEQ can offer, please visit iqeq.com. Goodbye.